China.
China is stealing intellectual property.
China would own our country if Joe Biden got elected.
We will never again be at the mercy of China.
Today, politicians compete to be anti-China.
China?
But just 20 years ago, they were so optimistic.
China's made great progress in building a new economy.
We know a future of greater trade and growth and human dignity is possible.
China had suddenly embraced free markets. They got rid of price controls, broke up collective farms, allowed foreign investment, and privatized state-run businesses. China was
rushing towards the future at breakneck speed.
People were so happy to finally see China being set on this path.
Melissa Chen reports on China for The Spectator.
It lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty for the very first time.
And then 3 years ago, something changed.
Yep, the rise of Xi Jinping.
He cracked down on speech, even jokes. Someone compared him to Winnie the Pooh.
They bore a striking resemblance.
From then on,
mentioning Winnie the Pooh ends up getting scrubbed from the internet.
When the internet first appeared, a lot of us thought it couldn't be censored.
China has been trying to crack down on the internet. Good luck. That's sort of like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall.
Well, the Chinese figured out how to nail Jell-O to the wall. They've built an almost perfectly walled-in internet.
China employs a million censors called the 50 Cent Army.
The 50 Cent Army is a bunch of online commentators that are hired by the Chinese Communist Party to basically manipulate public opinion.
They block the big international sites and most Western news media. People here generally don't get to see the World Wide Web we see. If you try to, they may barge into your home, threaten your family, restrict your choices.
Can't make doctor's appointments. They'll block you from buying a train ticket or a plane ticket.
Worse, if you're a Muslim like the Uyghurs, the Chinese will lock you up in re-education camps.
Sometimes for years, and their family never hears back from them.
But there's not been much reporting on this.
Right. And that's because China severely restricts the movement of journalists.
Some video taken from satellites or drones was posted on Twitter. We see blindfolded people with their heads shaved, their hands tied behind their backs.
China says these are vocational training camps.
That's what they claim. But satellite images tell a totally different story.
And Radio Free Asia says they've now added
this really creepy policy. When males of the Uyghurs are sent off to re-education camps, these Han Chinese males licensed by the party would come in and live with the family, sleep in the same bed as the wives.
Yet in America, protesters say America is the biggest oppressor.
Slavery, genocide, and war!
This recent New York Times editorial board member asked, is the United States better, worse, or the same as China? This is a difficult question to answer.
This equivalence is bonkers. There should be no doubt about the moral equivalence between the two countries.
Because in America,
you can criticize Donald Trump and hold up a sign in a protest saying, screw Donald Trump, the United States suck. But you cannot do anything remotely similar in China.
People in Hong Kong tried.
Nearly 2 million marching across the city to voice their anger.
Many waving American flags.
The Hong Kong people clearly have a hankering for American values. They crave for this freedom that we take for granted.
But now they too have been silenced. I wish these American democratic socialists.
That is a freaking communist Russian flag.
The Soviets would have called them useful idiots. I wish they understood what the Chinese people have learned. Socialism leads to real government oppression.
The communists broke our bones, but the Americans broke our hearts. Because while my people were waving the American flag in our streets, begging for freedom, Americans were waving the communist flag in their streets.
Why would Americans want this? Why would they be waving these communist flags, wanting socialism?
We'll never stop fighting for the smell of freedom. What about you, America?
We hope you enjoyed this video, and
please click that button. Help us make more.
Which candidate for president will bankrupt America first? Trump or Biden?
We're going to invest $1.7 trillion.
This video and our next one compare each candidate's plans for giving Americans free stuff.
Quadruple the funding.
Before the Democrats chose Joe Biden, we tallied the costs of the leading candidate's promises.
My plan costs $1.5 trillion.
At that time, Biden, to his credit, promised the least amount of new spending. Sadly, his new running mate was the one who promised the most.
Let's do this!
Her extravagant spending plans didn't help her. She fell in the polls and dropped out. But once Biden secured the delegates, he increased his spending plans.
We will mobilize the biggest investment in rebuilding our country since World War II.
Wait a second. I was told Democrats go left during the primaries.
To appeal to Democratic primary voters, you do have to go farther to the left.
And then come back to the middle to try to win the presidency.
Not this time.
Joe Biden has been lurching to the left on federal spending for years. First as senator, then as vice president, and now as a presidential candidate.
Pete Sepp runs the National Taxpayers Union. For years, they've rated politicians by how responsibly or irresponsibly they spend your money.
Tax spend and borrow is going to bankrupt the nation.
Joe Biden's $2 trillion climate proposal.
Biden increased his climate spending so much, you'd think Al Gore had won.
Invest $1 trillion in green infrastructure.
Cash rebates, low-cost financing, upgrade energy and efficient appliances. 500,000 charging stations.
For $500 billion a year, for 4 years.
$1 trillion in green infrastructure.
This is the way that governments grow, at the expense of the American people.
So they spend it, and so what? We'll have more infrastructure. Great.
What we won't have is infrastructure that's efficient or effective. We'll have holes in the ground and mass transit that people won't ride.
Biden also wants billions more for caregivers, for children and the elderly.
That's a good thing, right?
Why not leave more money in people's pockets to begin with so they can afford to take care of their families? We as taxpayers know better how to take care of our families and ourselves than some distant government in Washington, D.C.
Biden would also spend $64 billion more on housing subsidies.
Housing should be a right for people.
A right to housing. Well, the Constitution does give us the right to free speech, free exercise of religion. Why not a right to housing and college and health care? They're important too. But there's one key difference. A right to free speech just means government leaves us alone. But a right to housing or college or health care means government forcibly takes money from some and gives it to others. That's very different. Biden's new spending proposals now total more than $1 trillion a year.
We can't afford it, and we especially can't afford it now. Sooner or later, every nation faces a fiscal reckoning, and Joe Biden's policies, if enacted in full, are going to draw that reckoning closer.
Well, we've been taxing and spending and borrowing, and except for COVID, we were doing well.
Deficits and debt don't matter until suddenly, spectacularly, they do. And no one knows when doomsday will happen until it already has. Ask the folks in Greece. Ask the folks in Weimar, Germany.
If you earn 2 million in the morning but wanted to buy bread in the afternoon, you'd have to pay 2 billion.
Deficits and debt destroy economic growth. It's going to hurt the American people, and it's coming.
Are President Trump's spending plans better than Biden's? We'll cover that in my next video. The recent protests led many people to want to do something about racial injustice.
Two weeks ago, we announced Apple's Racial Equity and Justice Initiative with a commitment of $100 million.
Racial justice groups are being flooded with money.
Charitable giving is important and we should do it. It demonstrates our heart, but that's not enough.
This is a good thing, right?
It's a condescending thing, which probably won't do any good.
Radio host Larry Elder says this white guilt is absurd.
But we whites should be guilty. We are privileged.
Well, if the guilt causes you to do things that make things worse, then it's not helpful.
We ask for forgiveness from our black brothers and sisters.
It is unclear how bowing to some black people will reduce racial injustice.
Please forgive me. Please forgive us.
It is ridiculous. I would urge white people to chill and to stop helping us, because you're making things worse. To get black people angry so they think of themselves as victims. About racism. Racism has never been more insignificant a factor in one's success than right now.
It must be a huge problem, or there wouldn't be all this protest.
Well, they're being lied to.
By teachers, activists, and the media, he says.
I call out racism. That is maddening to me, and I'm crying about it because it's crazy.
And it gives young people the impression that racism remains this huge problem in America when it is not.
Not, he says, because today, any black person who does three things can succeed.
Finish high school, don't have a kid until you get married, get a job. Do those things, you will not be poor.
See, we got to keep black people angry.
This year, Elder made a movie called Uncle Tom that criticizes activist claims that blacks continue to be victims of America's racism.
If you keep yourself in this constant state of woe is me, I'm disadvantaged, I'll never accomplish anything, then you won't accomplish anything.
What really holds blacks back is not racism, says Elder, it's government handouts.
A mother with two children makes more money than she would make on minimum wage because of all the goodies she gets through the welfare state. In 1965, 25% of black kids were raised without fathers. The number is now 70%. And Black Lives Matter actually is encouraging that.
Their website does criticize the Western prescribed nuclear family. Karl Marx said things like that.
One of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter has admitted that she is a trained Marxist.
Myself and Alicia in particular are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists.
They're just phonies. Look at these protesters. They're all wearing Nike. They're all using Apple products. Do they really want socialism? Do they really want inferior products? They're hypocrites.
But the activists are winning, even redefining what racism means. Now it means
any policy that has an effect that is disproportionate.
Camille Foster of Freethink points out that today's best-selling books about anti-racism say any measure that produces or sustains racial inequality is racist, which means even a tax deduction is racist, because on average, whites deduct more than blacks.
Anti-racism presumes things about the world that simply can't be true. We're all at bottom, whatever our race, individuals. Anti-racism takes that and flips it on its head.
At this meeting, when a white man held a black child on his lap, he was told,
"It hurts people when they see a white man bouncing a brown baby on their lap."
I would like to know, before this meeting adjourns, how having my friend's nephew on my lap was hurtful to people.
Read a book. Read a book. Read Ibram Kendi. Read White Fragility.
Both bestsellers criticize whiteness. And recently, a taxpayer-funded Smithsonian project claimed white culture means things like a nuclear family, hard work, planning for the future.
There's something really despicable about a poster like this.
It was removed after complaints.
It's offensive to suggest that black people can't aspire to or can't possess all of the values that are outlined in a document like this. Black people can be punctual. Black people are, in fact, successful in this country.
These ideas, including English common law, scientific method, delaying gratification, are good things. They make life better for millions of people. Why dismiss them as mere whiteness? I wanted to ask Black Lives leaders about this. We contacted all 14 chapters. Not one would agree to an interview. I wish they would. I really wanted to ask them if they've noticed that they and white supremacists now promote similar things.
Endorsing segregationist policies, spaces for blacks only. They both believe that race is an immutable attribute of who we are.
I have a dream.
Foster and Larry Elder prefer Martin Luther King's vision.
That my four little children
will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
It used to be good to be colorblind.
The left does not want a colorblind society. They don't really want the vision of MLK. They want a color-coordinated society as long as they're the ones who are doing the coordinating. And it's hurting people.
It hurts anyone who comes to believe that hard work and delayed gratification are whiteness. Well, they are helpless victims.
I'm sick of people talking about, oh, when I go to a job, they're going to discriminate against me. What about white privilege? I don't want to hear a lick of that crap anymore. You're stronger than that. You're more powerful than that.
We need your help to keep making these videos. If you think they're useful, I do, please click that button. Today's continuing anti-racism protests include the claim that fossil fuel use is racist because climate change will hurt minorities most.
Climate crisis is a racist crisis.
Therefore,
the fossil fuel industry will have to pay.
But I wonder, have these people ever asked themselves,
can you turn your lights on in the morning?
Energy journalist Robert Bryce just made this documentary about the importance of electricity. Juice.
Having electricity doesn't guarantee wealth, but not having it almost always means poverty.
Here's our abbreviated version of his movie.
Electricity has allowed people, and in particular women and girls, to escape the drudgery of past eras. It has liberated them from the pump, the stove, and the washtub.
But still today, in much of the world, millions have little access to electricity. As a result,
the mothers are spending all day long just doing the basic household chores, collecting water.
You don't have a fridge, so you have to cook every evening.
Not only does electricity reduce labor, but also,
electricity has allowed us to conquer our oldest foe, darkness. For millennia, the cost of having well-lit spaces at night was so high that only the very rich could afford it.
That's still true in much of the world.
The power goes off. And I began crying consolably because there's no way I'm going to finish memorizing this times table where there's no power.
And when there's no power, people often heat their homes by burning things like cow dung.
Every year in India, more than 1 million people die from indoor air pollution.
That pollution's a much bigger killer than the fossil fuels American politicians complain about.
Whether we should continue producing fossil fuels. There's no debate.
No debate? But without fossil fuels, much of the world will freeze in the dark. We just don't yet have enough alternatives to gas and oil. Although one country almost does.
We're here in Iceland at Gullfoss Falls. As you can see, this country has enormous hydropower potential.
Iceland gets most of its power from constantly moving water. And because Iceland also has hot springs, it gets a quarter of its juice from geothermal power. So electricity is cheap there. But even in Iceland, they still burn oil. There just isn't enough renewable energy to power everything.
There are over 3 billion people in the world today without adequate access to electricity. In order to empower the low-watt world, we're going to need a lot more juice.
But what about climate change? We're told we must move to renewable energy. The planet is dying, and all we need to do is spend more on researching green power.
In every case where you've had massive infusions or requirements for renewable energy, you've seen costs increase.
So what? The planet is dying.
But it's regressive. It's going to have a bigger impact on low-income and middle-income Americans. That's putting a higher tax burden on the people who can least afford it.
His documentary argues that electricity matters so much, it's cruel to talk about limiting its use.
This idea that there's too many people and that we all have to reduce our energy consumption. The only people in the world who say that are rich people. I've never had a small farmer tell me that there's too many people and that we consume too much.
How are we going to have a population, all these bright young minds, if they're not plugged in? We have to plug them in now.
4 billion people are not going to say, we'll give up progress if it just slows global warming.
Energy poverty versus climate change. There is no easy one-size-fits-all solution. The only certainty is that people will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need.
You can now watch his entire documentary, subtitled How Electricity Explains the World, on iTunes.
Launch Control, Dragon, loud and clear.
These two American astronauts spent more than 2 months in space.
Ignition. Liftoff.
Their launch was the first manned launch from the U.S. in 10 years.
The Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon, go NASA!
Go NASA? Wait, why NASA? NASA hasn't sent anyone into space for years. This rocket was launched by Elon Musk.
Musk had not only done something that it was previously thought that only the governments of superpowers could do, he had done things that they thought they couldn't do, that no one could do.
Robert Zubrin, author of The Case for Space, points out that private companies now do what NASA couldn't even imagine doing, send people into space affordably.
This is the potential of free enterprise.
Apollo 11, this is Houston.
50 years ago, NASA did send astronauts to the moon.
We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained.
Makes me wonder, why did the moon landing succeed?
Apollo was purpose-driven. We wanted to astonish the world what free people could do.
But after that success, NASA became a typical government agency. Over budget, behind schedule.
When you don't have a truly commanding purpose, the purpose of the program becomes to supply money to various suppliers.
Like Lockheed Martin, where Zubrin worked, and where he discovered a way for this rocket to carry twice as much weight.
It doubled the payload capability for 10% extra cost. They said to us, look, if the Air Force wants us to improve the Titan, they'll pay us to do it.
Why would a private contractor not innovate? Because
the incentive structure is all messed up.
NASA pays contractors development costs and then adds 10% profit. The more projects cost, the bigger the contractor's profit.
You have good people engaged in cost maximization because you just gave them incentive to do that.
We have not been good at maintaining schedule, and we have not been good at maintaining cost.
And they aren't good at innovating. Governments never are. Only recently did the Pentagon stop using these floppy disks.
Astronauts would bring their laptops with them in space because the shuttle computers were obsolete.
When they saw that the astronauts were bringing their own computers, why didn't they upgrade?
Because they had an entire philosophy that various components had to be space rated, and the process of space rating something was very bureaucratic and costly.
Costly was okay with NASA, as long as spaceships were assembled in many congressmen's districts.
In some ways, NASA is a very large job program.
Aerospace lawyer James Dunstan.
By spreading its centers across the country, NASA can get more support from more different congressmen.
The current request calls for more than $21
billion. We'll welcome you back to Texas. It's been lots of money anytime.
But now, private competition has lowered the cost of getting to space. 11 years ago, an Obama committee concluded building a rocket as powerful as this
would take 12 years and cost $36 billion. Musk did it in 6 years for less than $1 billion. Because it was his money he was spending.
One Musk innovation was reusable rocket boosters. For years, NASA dropped theirs into the ocean.
Why would they throw it away?
Because that's the way it's always been done.
But Musk thought,
if you had to get a new plane every time you flew somewhere, very few people could afford to fly.
So he found a way to have them land safely so they can be used again. Zubrin suggested that to his bosses 20 years ago.
I went to a vice president and I pitched it to him. And he said, yeah, it's a real cute idea, Bob, but if we sell one of these, we're out of business. They wanted to keep the cost of space launch high.
But now that there's a list of competitors, launch prices are crashing.
Now there's a competition.
Bezos has Blue Origin, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic,
Boeing, SpaceX,
aerospace giant Lockheed Martin.
There's also Chinese SpaceX wannabes.
Building satellite launching rockets.
But Musk is testing still newer ideas.
By the time the Chinese copy him and have something as good as what he has now, he'll have something better.
Like Starship, his bigger spacecraft.
Taller than the Statue of Liberty.
It's meant to take people to Mars and back.
With a system like Starship, you could travel on Earth from anywhere to anywhere in less than an hour, flying through space. Because there's no friction in space.
What might be next?
You just don't know. You know, Benjamin Franklin was once asked after he did one of his electricity demonstrations, "This is fascinating, Dr. Franklin, but what possible use could this electricity ever have?" And he answered, "Of what use is a baby?"
All our most wonderful inventions started as babies. Government didn't know what to do with a Model T, the early computer, the Wright brothers' plane. It took competing entrepreneurs pursuing profit to turn them into the great things we have now. Let's celebrate the entrepreneurs who break government's old rules and take us to new places.
Reigniting the dream of space.
I hope you learn from these videos. We count on people like you to help us keep making them. So please, click that button.
Overnight, Minneapolis on fire.
When Minneapolis burned after police killed George Floyd, people wondered, why would this happen in Minneapolis? This is a city where politicians do most everything the protesters say they want.
The crowd erupted in cheers as the council voted unanimously to move ahead with a $15 minimum wage.
If you wanted a poster child for the progressive movement, it would be Minneapolis.
Minnesota Senate candidate Jason Lewis.
This is the same city council that voted to abolish the police department.
The council, which has no Republicans, spends money on most every progressive idea.
Climate change resilience and 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions.
They applaud themselves for forcing businesses to give workers more time off. They pushed taxpayer-subsidized housing.
It took members less than 5 minutes to approve this ordinance.
They passed that higher minimum wage.
We have now won $15.
But despite all those progressive policies meant to make life more fair,
the Minneapolis income gap between whites and African Americans is the second worst in the country.
That confuses the media. Minneapolis had progressive policies, says the Washington Post, but its economy still left black families behind. They choose the word but. The word should be therefore. After all,
when you take away the incentive for work and savings and investment, you get less of it.
When government sends checks to people who don't work, more people don't work.
There's a sign behind you that says Waverly Job Center. You have any intention of going in to get a job?
Not looking for a job.
And guarantees like a higher minimum wage and forced family leave raise the cost of workers, which means some people never get hired.
In Minneapolis, we now recycle organics.
And the higher taxes to pay for all the programs mean some businesses never open.
I've been touring the businesses that were burned. They did not mention global warming, recycling, or the environment one single time. You know what they say? Give me low taxes and give me public order. If you don't have good schools, low taxes, and low crime, you're not going to have small businessmen and women investing their lifetime of savings to open a business.
A creative tax cut, creating more jobs.
That used to be the hallmark of the Democratic Party when John Kennedy used to talk about it.
Democrats did once argue that limited government would allow free people to create wealth.
Now it's some command and control economy. And quite frankly, they're not even shy about it in Minnesota. Ilhan Omar the other day said, we need to abolish capitalism.
As long as our economy and political systems prioritize profit, we will perpetuate this inequality.
So we can have equal poverty for everybody.
She doesn't say she wants equal poverty. She thinks her ideas will lift everybody up.
Show us, Ilhan. Where's it worked? And everything they're proposing has it worked, which is why we're talking about Minneapolis.
We raise our fists for the innocent black lives subject to racial discrimination.
I think those disparities were caused by a long trail of historic racism.
Cam Gordon is a Minneapolis councilman. He wins elections here because he's in sync with local voters.
So you do have allies inside of government.
Gordon tweets things like,
time to end capitalism as we know it.
That would be good.
How would it be good?
We could have more democratic control of our resources.
every alternative to capitalism brings stagnation and poverty.
And I think that we can take care of each other better so that we're actually looking out for the vulnerable and the needy, and also making sure that we have an opportunity to right the wrongs of the past.
We are demanding justice, not just for Floyd, but for a corrupt system.
Because racism has never been over.
Who didn't want justice for Mr. Floyd? There was unanimity from everybody. The Democrat county attorney got the policeman charged in 4 days, the fastest ever. What does that have to do with abolishing our economic system?
They would say economic freedom just means white people, insiders, get rich.
But when we had this economic engine going before the lockdown, the people gaining the most were at the bottom end of the wage scale. A rising tide truly lifts all boats.
He's right. In the past 50 years, while progressives attack profits,
feed the rich and feed the poor,
that pursuit of profit, capitalism, lifted more than a billion people around the world out of the misery of extreme poverty.
The problem with capitalism as we know it is there seems to be this idea that we have to have constant growth.
Growth works. Growth lifts many of the poor.
But it lifts the rich much faster.
So what if the rich get filthy rich? If the poor do better too?
Capitalism, as we know, it's got us the housing crisis right now, and it's got us climate change that's actually going to destroy the planet.
But your ideas are going to bring poverty and tyranny. They have again and again. Every time it's been tried. The idea.
What idea? Community-based economics?
These are families that are 42% black.
By community-based, he means the community will decide what everyone must be paid, what landlords may charge, even what grocery stores stock. Sure sounds like socialism to me.
When socialism fails, the apologists always say, we just didn't do it enough. We just didn't do it the right way. That's always been the case, and it's always failed.
Do voice your opinions? Watch out. You might get fired.
He has resigned,
stepping down after controversial comments.
The opinion editor of the New York Times has just resigned.
You probably heard about this man losing his job because he approved an op-ed by Republican Senator Tom Cotton. It was headlined, "Send in the troops to restore order when there are riots." Sometimes reporters claimed,
"That is a dangerous, dangerous thing for the New York Times to have published."
Many tweeted the exact same wording, saying it put their lives in danger.
But it didn't put their lives in danger.
No, it didn't. It's absurd.
Robbie Suave reports on today's young radicals, like the ones at the New York Times.
Their union promoted it because that language spoke to a potential legal concern, harassment law. That's their tactic for seizing power in the workplace.
Where did this tactic come from?
It's not a debate.
It started on college campuses.
You have created space for violence. I disagree with that.
Several years ago, this mob of angry students at Yale surrounded this professor.
Why can't you say sorry?
Saying sorry is never enough.
Look at me. Yes. Look at me. Yes. Your experiences will never connect to mine. Empathy is not necessary for you to understand that you're wrong.
What horrible thing had Professor Nicholas Christakis done? He defended his wife sending out a pre-Halloween email saying, whose business is it to control costumes of young people like turbans or headdresses just because they come from other cultures?
The message that you sent proclaiming that cultural appropriation on Halloween is totally permissible is hurtful.
Apologize!
I want to make sure.
I understand. Like,
they screamed at him for an hour. There's nothing he could say to them to convince them. They're just trying to punish someone, to humiliate someone who disagrees with their tactics.
I do not respect you.
I don't hear that.
I'm looking at the smirk in your face and I'm disgusted.
Okay.
But now I am actually angry, sir. I really, do not interrupt me. I was not angry, and now I want your job to be taken from you.
It was. He had to step down as head of a residential hall. His wife had to stop teaching. The mob won. It won at campus after campus. Now these students have graduated.
They're now moving off the campus and into the broader culture. And into the workplace.
Where they demand that people not say certain things. At the Philadelphia Inquirer.
There was an article published in the paper with the title, Buildings Matter Too.
It was a bad headline, linking buildings with black lives.
44 staff members claim this carelessness puts our lives at risk. Their letter didn't give any evidence how it threatened their lives, but they won.
The top editor at the Inquirer resigned.
Then young activists at NBC News tried to silence The Federalist, a respected conservative site that NBC smeared as far right. What had The Federalist done? Published a column that said, correctly, the media had falsely claimed violent riots were peaceful. But it also quoted a government official saying tear gas was not used against rioters, which turned out not to be true. So NBC then claimed Google blocked The Federalist from advertising after NBC's verification unit brought it to Google's attention.
An apparent push by NBC to remove ads from The Federalist site.
The reporter even thanked left-wing activist groups for their collaboration. But it turned out that NBC's report was just wrong.
Google tonight saying that's not true.
So the activist mob failed here.
Jace is all on the case.
Some people want to cancel Paw Patrol.
What the activists are saying, we should have fewer positive portrayals of law enforcement in the media.
Being a police dog takes a lot of hard work.
So some people said defund Paw Patrol for brainwashing kids into thinking law enforcement's noble and just.
So we're sitting here telling you that you are being racist, you are being offensive.
Today's young activists say, we know what's just, and it's our job to stop you from saying offensive things.
How can you allow someone to say something that offends me?
The problem with that is,
we're supposed to occasionally offend each other, because you might be wrong. We have to have a conversation about it. We have to challenge dogma. What if we were still with the principle that you couldn't speak out against the king? That's the history of the Middle Ages, is people suffering violent consequences for daring to offend people.
Galileo was arrested for saying the earth revolved around the sun.
That's the conditions that all humans lived under, and it was a much less happy place. Then we came to an idea that, no, we improve society by having frank and sometimes difficult conversations about how we're going to get along and live together.
But now, influential young people say some things must never be said.
It's starting at some elite media institutions, but I predict that it will spread out further unless a serious effort is made by people to confront it.
I hope you learned something from these videos, and if you'd like to help us keep making more, please click that button.
If we don't do this, 2.2 million people die.
2.2 million people.
That was the prediction early in the pandemic. It came from experts at London's Imperial College.
The Imperial College model became enormously influential all around the world.
Science reporter Matt Ridley points out that the model led governments to act.
A statewide order for people to stay at home.
Everything we do is based scrupulously on the best scientific advice.
Politicians always say, I'm following the science.
There is no such thing as the science. There is science, and science consists of people disagreeing with each other.
The model did say that if all Americans practiced social distancing, we could reduce the death toll to a million plus. But even without everyone distancing, our death toll has been much lower than that.
We've seen far too much reliance on models, which have very, very dodgy assumptions.
100% of the workforce must stay home.
Actually, what we did was quite dangerously wrong.
Because the model said COVID patients would overwhelm hospitals.
Patients were moved out of hospitals into care homes.
Where the virus killed the most people.
Go home and stay home.
The strict lockdowns may have done more harm than good. Norway's health chief now says a lockdown was not needed to tame COVID.
The main interventions that helped prevent people dying were things like stopping large gatherings, people washing their hands and wearing face masks, general social distancing, not forcing people to stay at home.
But governments did force people to stay home because the models misled them.
We all failed at that business, right? All the early national experts, here's my projection model, here's my projection model. They were all wrong.
But he and others should have known that the Imperial College researchers have a history of failure. Imperial predicted 136,000 deaths from mad cow disease, 65,000 from swine flu, 200 million from bird flu. The real numbers were in the hundreds.
Wrong again and again, and they just get believed the next time.
If you say something really pessimistic about how many people are going to die, the media want to believe you, the politicians daren't not believe you.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change.
This bias toward pessimism applies to climate change, too. Most of those predictions are based on models. Ever been to a Maldive island? 32 years ago, so-called experts said rising seas would completely cover the Maldives in the next 30 years. But it's been longer than that. The islands are thriving. They're even building new islands.
The Maldives are building several new airports. That does not suggest a country that is about to disappear beneath the waves. Climate change is real, is happening, but is not happening nearly as fast as models predicted, and we have time to sort out our economy.
Why do the models again and again, and the scientists behind them, overpredict disaster?
Predicting disaster is a very good way of attracting attention to your science and getting rewarded for it.
2020, we're out of oil.
We are at or near peak oil.
75% of our energy are simply running out.
The experts all said, we're about to run out of oil.
In fact, the opposite happened.
Ridley's new book explains how innovators repeatedly prove models wrong. In the case of oil and gas, higher prices inspired entrepreneurs to invent new ways of getting more gas out of the same rocks.
We were forecasting 10 years ago that gas prices would go up rapidly, less rapidly, or slowly. We did not have a forecast in which they went down, and yet that's actually what happened.
It turns out experts are wrong all the time. The head of the British Royal Society said heavier-than-air flying machines are impossible. In 1955, Variety said rock and roll music will be gone by June. Columnist Paul Krugman said the internet's impact on the economy will be no greater than the fax machines.
Experts do get things wrong, but they're more likely to be right than a layperson.
Tom Nichols wrote this book that says we should trust experts more. I asked him about the Maldives.
Everybody said they were going to be underwater by now. Everybody was wrong.
Expertise gets politicized. This happens in every field of expertise because we're human beings and we want our expert sources to reach the same conclusions that we want to reach.
We shouldn't dismiss the expertise of a doctor or an engineer when they're curing your disease or building your bridge. But we need to learn that there is no such thing as expertise on the future.
People tell me it's dangerous what people like you or I say, that people aren't going to obey the government's rules.
It's dangerous to rely too much on models that give you wrong answers and end up locking down society and destroying people's livelihoods. Danger lies both ways.
If you like these videos and would like us to make more, please help us do that. Press that button.